Good day, Crime Talk aficionados. This is Crime Talk, and my name is Scott Reich. A quick preview of today's docket. First, Lori Vallow's extremely complex and fragile mental health. What does that really mean? The worst cook in America is now officially the worst foster care mother in America. A Casey White and Vicky White update. An inmate's last words. Let's do this. You have to respect that. An example of why I don't do family law. And then finally, our dumb criminal of the day. Let's talk about it. All right, aficionados, you know the drill. Subscribe if you have not. Like the video. Leave me a comment. Hit that bell so you receive notifications. Remember, you can listen to us on your favorite podcasting app by searching Crime Talk with Scott Reich. And before we get to the day's docket, well, please support the sponsors that help us. Let's go ahead and listen to the ad. Like many Americans, we got a dog during the pandemic. My quarantine dog, Miss Winnie the Bulldog. Now, Miss Winnie has grown accustomed to being around us all the time. When we were leaving the house, Winnie would have extreme anxiety, so we decided to look for natural products to help with her anxiety. We looked for the highest quality CBD treats, and we were not satisfied, and neither was Winnie. So we created a high-quality CBD product that absorbs faster and provides the required results faster. Baked in Colorado, CBD treats and beverage enhancers are made with nanotechnology. The nanotechnology makes the CBD extraction more pure, also allows for Baked in Colorado products to work faster. Baked in Colorado products can help reduce your pet's anxiety, ease joint pain, and help with your dog's skin problems. Go to our online store and see what Baked in Colorado product is best for your dog. When you order at bakedincolorado.com, enter code Winnie and receive 15% off your first order. We have a 30-day money-back guarantee. If your dog does not experience the desired results in 30 days, return the product and we will refund your money. No questions asked. All right, today is Friday, May 13th, 2022. Big shout out to Julie's mom. It's her birthday. All right, let's go ahead and open the docket. All right, first on the docket, Lori Vallow's extremely complex and fragile mental health. What does that mean and how did we get here? Well, as you may recall, we talked about it earlier in the week that the prosecution has filed a motion to basically join Lori Vallow's trial date, which is now set for October, with that of her husband, Chad Daybell, which is set to start in early January of 2023. You may say, well, why is that the case? Well, Lori Vallow had been at the state hospital having to be restored or have her competency restored so that she was fit to stand trial. So she did not enter a plea of not guilty at her arraignment as early as Chad Daybell did. Well, Chad Daybell waived speedy trial so that they could set a trial date out in January, which gave everybody time to prepare for trial, even though everybody's had 2.5 years to be working on this case thus far. Well, when Lori appeared last month for an arraignment, she did not agree to waive speedy trial. Under the Idaho Constitution, every defendant is entitled to have their trial within 6 months from the date that they enter a plea of not guilty. Therefore, the judge then set the trial for Lori Vallow to begin in October. The prosecution said, hey, there's this little exception in the speedy trial statute that gives the judge the authority to set a trial date beyond the speedy trial date if there are certain things that would take place, i.e., for example, one, the defendant wouldn't be prejudiced in any way. It's not a huge delay. And basically, it just makes good judicial economy to do that. However, a plain reading of the statute clearly says 6 months. And on a death penalty case, why do you want to mess around on something like that that could get reversed if, let's say, hypothetically, the judge says, fine, I will set Lori Vallow's trial into the next year in January with Chad Daybell. And if Lori Vallow doesn't explicitly waive speedy trial, that is an appellate issue. And if the Court of Appeals said, hey, judge, you shouldn't have done that, guess what? Lori Vallow goes free. She walks, okay? So I keep saying, just let the prosecution go try their case. I keep telling the prosecution, not that they have to listen to anything I have to say, which is just go try the case. If you have to do it twice, go do it. Well, the defense for Lori Vallow, the defense attorneys, have filed a response to the motion to continue. And I think it's worth reading a better part of the motion because it's not that long and it gives some context. And I'll explain what I think it means. And it says, you know, comes now the defendant, hereby we respond. The defendant has been incarcerated and hospitalized for 2 years since her arrest on February 20th of 2020. She has reviewed with counsel the court's order regarding the joining of her case with her husband Chad Daybell's case for purposes of a jury trial. She has reviewed with counsel the court's order denying Chad Daybell's request for separate trials. She has instructed her attorneys not to file a request for a separate trial. Although in custody for over 2 years, Lori Vallow was just arraigned on this indictment on April 19th of 2022, and she had previously hired private counsel when arrested in 2020, but was found to be indigent prior to her hospitalization in 2021. Pursuant to the recently amended Rule 44.3 Idaho Criminal Rules, the trial court did not and could not authorize the spending of public funds for a defense team until she was arraigned. A fully funded defense team at public expense was approved at her arraignment on April 19th, 2020. As the need arises, other experts may be hired for the defense. She, referring to Lori Vallow, has met several times with her defense team, currently consisting of lead counsel, co-counsel, a mitigation specialist, and an investigator. She understands that her defense team is spending a considerable amount of time going through the mountain of discovery in this case in order to get ready for trial. She understands that the defense team is in the process of identifying and interviewing witnesses for the trial and for the potential sentencing if there is a conviction. She understands that the heightened scrutiny in a death penalty potential case. Lori Vallow's mental health is extremely complex and fragile, and she has the potential to be hospitalized again in the near future. None of the experts employed by the court and the state of Idaho Department of Health and Welfare claim she is malingering or making up her mental illness. She understands that she will undergo further mental health testing as a neuropsychologist approved for the defense team will be meeting with her next month. She understands her right to a speedy trial and does not want to waive that right. If the court moves her trial from October 11th, 2022 to January 9th, 2023, she understands that will give her defense team more time to get ready. So let's read between the lines, okay? Only the defendant can agree to waive speedy trial. Okay. The defense attorneys have said, hey, judge, even though I've been on this case for a while, Lori Vallow hasn't been arraigned, so I couldn't really dig into it. And I couldn't get a defense team for a death penalty case until arraignment. So I'm a little bit hindered here. And she's only met a couple of times with her attorneys, investigator, mitigation specialist, and her investigator. So they could have worked on the case, but they weren't going to get paid for it. Because that's the rule, right? State money, got to be real frugal with it, right? Not making a whole lot of sense here. They're also putting the court on notice that they are having concerns as to her mental health and her competency, basically by saying it's extremely complex and she has the potential to be hospitalized again. That's the defense team saying, judge, I know she's back. I know she's competent in the eyes of the court so far, but I'm not so convinced this is going to last. Okay. That's what he's trying to telegraph to the court. And he's saying she has been advised that the court wants to join these cases or already has. She's also aware that Chad, her husband, through his attorney, has filed a motion to want a separate trial. She's also aware of the fact that she has a right to a trial within 6 months, and she's not prepared to waive that. But she also understands that if the court continues the trial to January of next year, that that'll give her attorneys more time, which is basically the defense attorney saying she won't agree to waive speedy trial, The attorneys need more time to prepare since we're really just getting up to speed, Judge. So although she can't waive speedy trial or won't waive speedy trial, I don't have the authority to do so as her attorney. But if you do it and you come to this conclusion, she's basically okay with that as well, which probably goes to the whole issue of whether she truly understands and appreciates what is taking place, which comes back ultimately to the competency issue. We will have to wait and see. Does the judge say, you know what, I'm just going to extend it. It's going to give everybody a little more time. He'll have to engage in a colloquy, a conversation with Lori Vallow and say, you understand you have your right? You sure you don't want to waive speedy trial? Because I'll give you a trial within 6 months. But I also have this little provision that says I can maybe do it. But guess what? If I'm wrong, it gets reversed on appeal. She walks free. No do-over. That's it. She walks. Why would the prosecution even take that chance? I just don't understand it. Once again, prosecution should say, you tell us where, Judge, you tell us when, we'll have our witnesses, we'll have our evidence, and we will prove this case beyond a reasonable doubt. We'll see if the prosecution really wants to risk that. The defense team is basically telling the judge, we've advised her, we need more time, but she's not willing to waive speedy trial. But she's okay with it, which kind of goes back to, does she really understand and appreciate what's taking place here? Can she assist in her defense in making these type of decisions, which goes directly to competency, which they're also indicating that it may be an issue here again really, really soon. All right, there you go. Hopefully that makes sense. Hopefully clear as mud. Before we move on from Lori Vallow, though, a couple of questions that were sent to us that were kind of predominant and basically worth asking. Question is, what is the point of the neuropsychologist after two psychiatrists found her competent at the mental health hospital? It's a death penalty case. The neuropsychologist is going to do lots and lots of tests, frankly, more than what would be done when they are determining if somebody is in fact competent to proceed. Why does she have these mental health issues? Was there something that helped cause it? You know, did she hit her head? Was she diseased? Who knows? There's got to be something that potentially caused the issue. The neuropsychologist, it's all mitigation. Think about it. Everything that could potentially reduce a punishment is mitigation. Whether it's a neuropsychologist exam, mental health issues, psychiatrists, that's all mitigation, which may save her from basically not being put to death if she is in fact convicted. We'll have to wait and see. Second question. Is this filing basically Lori putting the court on notice that she's going to be mentally incompetent again? As I mentioned, I think it is the attorney saying, we've got some real concerns, okay? And just because somebody has been found incompetent and then restored to competency doesn't mean that they can basically remain competent. They can fade out of competency, so to speak. I know that's a very technical term there. But the reality of it is the attorneys have a duty. They have an ethical obligation not only to the court and their client to raise that issue at any time that they think that their client may not be competent to proceed. So I think it's the defense attorneys telegraphing to the court, hey, judge, you got to understand the situation that I'm dealing with. I'm dealing with a client that seems somewhat maybe indifferent. Maybe he doesn't understand what's going on. We'll see what happens. The hearing will be held on the 19th. It will be live streamed. We'll be bringing it to you. All right. Next on the docket, the worst cook in America is now officially the worst foster care mother in America. Congratulations, Ariel Robinson. That's right. The Ariel Robinson, once the winner of the Food Network show's Worst Cook in America, was found guilty of homicide by child abuse and sentenced to life in prison. Now, Ms. Robinson of Greenville, South Carolina, was found guilty after jurors deliberated for just an hour and a half following a four-day trial. Ms. Robinson and her husband, Jerry, were arrested back in 2021 after the death of their three-year-old foster daughter, Victoria Rose Smith. In April, Jared pled guilty to aiding and abetting homicide by child abuse, and police found Victoria unresponsive after responding to a 911 call at the Robinson's house on January 14th of 2021. Robinson claimed at the time that the toddler went limp after ingesting an excess of liquids and that she thought the girl had choked. When asked about the other bruises found all over the toddler's young little body, Ariel stated, She allegedly blamed Victoria's brother. Prosecutors argue that Robinson had, in fact, fatally beaten Victoria that evening. And the Greenville County Chief Medical Examiner, a guy by the name of Dr. Michael Ward, testified that the child was beaten so severely that her blood vessels burst. He said that the blood that subsequently collected in her muscles and body fat may have actually killed her. Jerry Robinson later told authorities that the fatal beating was spurred by an incident the day before when Victoria vomited on the way to church and angered Ariel. Victoria's biological great aunt, Michelle Earps, blames social workers for not paying proper attention to the situation, and she says she noticed possible bruises and markings on Victoria's body in pictures Ariel had uploaded to social media. Ariel teared up talking about Victoria on the stand on Thursday, describing her as a perfect little child. Now, Earps started a petition on the change.org website calling on state lawmakers to pass a bill called Victoria's Law, which would reform the South Carolina Department of Social Services. The petition currently has nearly 46,000 signatures. Those are always tough cases. I am telling you, I would rather do a good old-fashioned gang shooting than a child abuse resulting in death case because, well, other than the parent sitting next to you, you are the worst, most despised person in the courtroom after that, so to speak. They're just tough cases. And it's just kind of a rule of nature that a mother and somebody stepping in as a stepmother does one thing in throughout nature, and that is to protect their child. And when they don't do that, let alone they harm it, guess what? Juries don't have a whole lot of sympathy for somebody, obviously the size of Ariel, versus that small child. Yeah, that's right. She needed to pick on somebody her own size, not a little kid. That's why it took an hour and a half. Next on the docket, Casey White. Well, Casey White has a mother, if you can believe that. That's right. And she says that Casey really loved Vicky White and is devastated by her death. And the mother has said that her son openly wept on the prison phone call to her the day after Vicky reportedly shot herself in the head, according to Casey's mom. They were just two people who really loved each other, and it was just so sad, and she worries for Casey. This is always the situation that you run into at sentencing. Everybody shows up when they have this incident going on in court, but it makes you wonder, where was mom all those years when Casey was out there running the streets, harming people, robbing people, allegedly killing people, escaping from prison, right? Where was she to be found now? Now she's like mom of the year? Give me a break. Anyway, well, Casey White, he's back now in Alabama. He's been transferred to a maximum security facility. And Casey White's mom says that Vicky was really good to him, and she was already there to talk to him. And that their relationship was really the real thing. His mom says there's been some speculation as to who pulled the trigger, and some people think that maybe Casey White pulled the trigger on his lover. His mother said that's simply not possible, and that he, in fact, loved her so much, put her in a situation where she quit her job of some 17 years, where she was a model employee, sold her worldly belongings, some $90,000 in cash, took it with her, and helped a man serving 75 years in prison, which is probably going to spend the rest of his life in prison upon conviction in his next upcoming case. Yeah, he really cared for her, didn't he? I don't think so. Not so much. And of course, mom says he's not the monster that everybody portrays him to be. Yeah, I'm going to go with that. I'm going to go with he is. I'm going to go with, yes, he is in fact a monster. And the police did note that when they found the vehicle and they found Vicky in there, they found some $29,000 of the $90,000 that Vicky had withdrawn from her bank accounts while she was on the run. And a lot of people, including Vicky's friends, are baffled by her actions. Anyway, that's a sad, sad situation. I don't know, you know, this Casey White guy, not a good guy. Let's face it, he's not. Vicky White, I guess she just fell in love and figured this was it. The only way she's ever going to be with this guy was to break him out of the slammer and go on the run. Didn't end well. Didn't think it would. But I thought it would be the other way around. Maybe that Casey White would be the one that's deceased. But all right, next on the docket. You know a condemned prisoner, you got to give him a little bit of respect when he says, let's do this, okay? So back in 1985, Clarence Dixon strangled, sexually assaulted, and stabbed a 19-year-old by the name of Deanna Bodwin, a student at the University of Arizona. He lived opposite her and was a student at the time. He was convicted of the sexual assault and murder and died by lethal injection in Florence, Arizona yesterday. Now, just before he was killed, Dixon's last words, the Arizona Supreme Court should follow the laws. They denied my appeals and petition to change the outcome of this trial. I do and will always proclaim innocence. Now let's do this. You gotta admire that. Seriously, you do. Anyway, you may not like the decision, but he knows it was over. It's like, let's do it. Let's get it on. It's nothing better like when you go to sentencing. You're like, judge, I know you're going to pose the maximum sentence. Like, let's have a client that says, let's bring it on. Do what you got to do. I love that attitude. Anyway, well, Mr. Dixon, prior to his demise, was 66 and the first inmate to be put to death in Arizona in 8 years, but the sixth in America to be executed this year. Now, Bodwin's sister, Leslie, spoke after the execution. Today, the process has been finalized. 43 and 20, the number of the hearings and the number of years that she has attended since the indictment. That's right, ladies and gentlemen, that's how long it usually takes. And 20 years is pretty quick on a death penalty case. Her sister continued saying, we should have been able to grow old together. I wish you all could have known her. She said afterwards, she said that she had no idea it would take so long to execute the man who in fact killed her sister. That's what people don't realize. It will literally take millions and millions of dollars and decades to put somebody to death. And once the order comes down, there's usually one more order or some other plan to try and make it be stopped. But eventually, like in all criminal cases, there has to be finality, and that's the way it has to be. Next on the docket, this is why I do not do family law. Okay, I've handled probably 3 family law cases in 27 years. And every time I did one, I swore I would never do another one. And this is an example of why. So in December of last year, Lacey Hucks, she was 33, and Angel Moore, she's 44, allegedly screenshotted 857 explicit images of minors from the dark web using Hucks' husband's old phone. The plan was for Huck's husband to get arrested so she could win an upcoming custody case. The two women were arrested this week for the alleged plot. On April 18th, Moore allegedly claimed that Huck's drove her to the Wynwood Police Department to file a police report and provided cops with Huck's husband's old phone. Moore reportedly also stated that she had witnessed Huck's husband view the alleged Evergano at the home. The husband was jailed overnight due to the allegations. However, investigators reportedly grew suspicious when they could not locate the girl on the current phone. Now, Garvin County Sheriff, a guy by the name of Jim Mullett, said that Huck's story was initially believable. However, in addition to the discrepancies between the two phones, Ms. Moore allegedly confessed to the plot, telling police she participated because she thought she was helping Ms. Hucks. Now, Moore and Hucks were charged with aggravated possession of child pornography, conspiracy to commit a felony, and violation of computer crimes. Ms. Moore bonded out of jail, while Ms. Hucks remains behind bars on a $250,000 bond. So let me explain, ladies and gentlemen. This is why I don't do divorce law. Give me a good old-fashioned criminal case, okay? First, it will come to an end. Divorce cases never do, particularly if there's in fact children. And it will drag on because it's not about simply what's in the best interest of the children. It's not about simply dividing up the property and the debts. It's usually about hurting the other party. Exhibit A, the case that we just talked about. Bottom line, it's about hurting the other person. Ms. Hucks and Ms. Moore, evil, evil people. We'll give them the presumption of innocence, but to plant photos like that so that she could gain an advantage in a custody proceeding, that is over the top. And guess what? Maybe she could join one of the worst mothers in America. You don't do that. And to put somebody, make accusations against somebody that could send them to prison for decades themselves, that is just evil and wrong. And finally, the moment you've all been waiting for, a quick recap of the dumb criminals of the day spread out throughout the week. First, on Monday, we had Kyle Elias Perez, who beat up his ex-boyfriend after having an argument about the ex-boyfriend's uncircumcised penis. That's right. Tuesday, Jacob Ryan Philbeck made a series of 911 calls to inform dispatch that President Joe Biden should be jailed and the drug lord El Chapo should in fact be free. Thursday, a 31-year-old suspect accidentally texted a Chesterfield County Sheriff's deputy on his personal cell phone number with a picture of a firearm and a bag of marijuana. The two made a plan to meet up and the suspect was arrested. That suspect had no idea how and why he texted the deputy, but it was all about the money. Got to make some money. And today, officers say a Florida woman by the name of Christine Turman was mad at victim Lawrence Stenzel due to his chicken pooping on his back patio. So Turman went inside, got a bucket of pee from her bathroom, walked out on the back patio, and threw the full bucket of pee at Stenzel. The arrest report does not indicate why Turman had a bucket of waste at the ready. Turman reportedly admitted to her actions after being read her rights. Of course she did. And Ms. Turman was booked into the county jail on a misdemeanor battery charge and was released on a $500 bond. What is it with food and excrement? I do not get it. Anyway, thanks for watching. Let's go ahead and close today's record. We'll see you next time on Crime Talk. Have a wonderful weekend.